What is up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Rewired Soul Podcast. It's your host, Chris, and today I am speaking with an author and scientific journalist, Tara Hale. So check it out. She has two books out. The first one was called The Informed Parent. All right. And the next one is all about vaccines and investigating vaccines. So Tara writes a ton. She's a scientific journalist, but yeah, I came across her work and it's so important and so relevant because I'm a father. I know a lot of you are parents, and yeah, there's a lot of, you know, discussions, debates, controversy around vaccinating our children. Like most adults, not most adults, but there is a group of adults that are concerned about taking the COVID vaccine. But, you know, a while back, they, approved the vaccine for 12 and up. My son's 12. We got him vaccinated and all that. And now they're still trying to get authorization to vaccinate younger kids. But yeah, this is such an important conversation. And Tara, you know, the first book that she co-authored, it was all about, you know, parents kind of understanding how to weigh the risks and understanding the truth behind vaccines. And that's a lot of what we talk about in this conversation. And I talked with her about how when my son was born, we were hesitant about vaccines because of some misinformation that was floating around, the research that we had to do. So we talk about this too. So it's not just a conversation to help us as parents, but for all of us to become better scientific thinkers. And I ask her a lot of questions on how to, like, you know, vet proper information, because she's interviewing a lot of scientists and, you know, she knows that there's debates within the scientific community and how she kind of weeds through that. But something else that's really important that we discuss is how to teach our kids how to think a little bit more critically and scientifically, and what information to trust and what information to question a little. So there's so much of that in this conversation. I had a blast talking with her. She's doing great work. It's super important. I love talking with science writers because, you know, anybody who's taking, you know, these kind of complex topics and getting them that out to the wider audience, like, I love it. So yeah, so make sure you check down in the description below. Make sure you're following Tara over on Twitter. I will also link both of her books down below. And before we get started, while you're down there, make sure that you follow me over on Instagram and Twitter at The Rewired Soul. All right. And by the way, there were some weird kind of internet issues and I edited it as best as possible. I think that I did a pretty good job. So yeah, so I hope you don't mind. But yeah, I think it came out pretty good. But just to warn you too, I have maybe like two episodes in the bank that are coming up in the coming weeks where there were some internet connection issues as well, where I'm trying to edit it as best as possible. So bear with me just a little bit. You never know what the wacky internet's going to do. And that's one of the things about doing podcasts in a pandemic and all that. But yeah, I tried to edit them. And if you have any feedback or suggestions on how to edit it better, hit me up anytime. Anyways, without further ado, here's my conversation with Tara Hale, not just about her books, but about all these conversations around vaccines. So I hope you enjoy. All right. Hello, Tara. Thank you so much for joining me. How are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. You do awesome work and your books are more relevant than ever. And yeah, so first, for those who are unfamiliar with your books and your work, you have two books out, The Informed Parent and Vaccination Investigation. So can you kind of explain what led to even the first book, The Informed Parent? Like, that's something I needed when my son was born. So can you talk a little bit about what inspired that?
Yeah, that book was co-written by myself and Emily Willingham, who's another science journalist with a PhD in developmental biology. Mm. And basically, I wrote the book that I wish I had had. Yeah. Whenever I had my kids, I was looking at parenting books. I found it really frustrating that all the parenting books that were out there that I could find, they all had an agenda. They were all advice books where they were telling me, you know, do this, don't do that, do this, don't do that. And I didn't really want someone telling me what to do. I just wanted to know, what does the science say about this and that? And, you know, I wanted to be able to make my own decisions, but I wanted them to be evidence-based. I wanted them to be informed by what we knew. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't find anything that would just tell me what the science said without telling me what to do or implying that was, you know, the final be all end all, you know, science says kind of thing. And so that was the impetus behind the book. Emily had a similar impetus. She was frustrated and fed up with all of the judgmentalness that was in all the existing parenting books. There was just sort of this underlying implication that if you didn't do things this way, you were a bad parent. And, you know, neither of us liked that. We wanted something that just kind of gave us the information. So that was the book that we wrote. It was actually funny when our first draft of that book, we submitted to our editor, it was twice as long as the one that got published. So it was, we could have easily done like a volume one, volume two.
Yeah. Yeah. When I came across the book, I'm like, well, this is a thick book, but yeah, like it is, it's so important. And it's funny because like you were saying, when my son was born, these are questions that I had and everything. So real quick story, my son's mom, she worked with children with autism, like for a very long time, leading up to the time my son was born. And when was he? So he was born in 2008, and I the Wakefield stuff happened years before that. But with her working with so many children with autism, and she would work with them at their houses, of course, she was flooded with those kind of talks about vaccines lead to autism and all that. And, you know, I think this topic is very personal to me because we actually delayed his vaccines for a while because of that information, right? You know,
and a lot of people did. Yeah.
Yeah. It's nuts. Like she, you know, before we like, she was cool about it. And before we got him vaccinated, I think even while she was pregnant, she had me watch this documentary about Andrew Wakefield. And, you know, me not knowing anything, you know, about science or how to look at this stuff, I was like, oh man, I don't want this to happen to my kid. But thankfully, you know, we had some conversations with our pediatrician and got him vaccinated. But, you know, the Wakefield stuff, that was like, what, 20 years ago when that came out, and then it got, you know, retracted from The Lancet. Like, what have you seen how that's still having lasting effects around vaccinations for children?
Oh, it's still having a huge impact. Andrew Wakefield himself is still very active in the anti-vaccine community and spreading misinformation. And oh my God, when you said 20 years, you're right. I hadn't thought about that. It has been 20 years. It's been 23 years to be exact. He published the paper in 98. It didn't really make it across the pond until about 2000. So it's, you know, this is the early days before, I mean, the internet was around, obviously, but it was in its infancy in terms of the way it's used today. I mean, I shouldn't say it was in its infancy. I mean, it was in its infancy in the 70s, but it was not, you know, we didn't have as much widespread use of it to get the news like we do now. And then it was retracted in 2010. And that's actually when my son was born and what led me to get involved in writing about vaccines, because I had seen all this, you know, hubbub about autism vaccines, what this, what that. And I wanted to know, like, what's the deal with the vaccines? And so I started looking into it. I was fortunate in that I was in grad school, so I had the time and the opportunity to really kind of throw myself into investigating it all. And that was actually the start of my writing about vaccines. That's what brought me into it. Mm-hmm. But it was very confusing early on. I remember thinking, like, how do I sort through all this? You know, how do I know what's true and what's not true? And I didn't know how to read a scientific study. That was all brand new to me. So, you know, it was a very confusing and frustrating experience. And so I really understand where parents are coming from when they're trying to make sense of all of this. All of those, you know, the autism thing was never the only concern, but there's been lots of concerns in general about, you know, in terms of the anti-vaccine messaging, in terms of, will this cause brain damage? Will this hurt my child long term? You know, there's a concern in the year 2000, 99, in that range, about thimerosal, and RFK Jr., Robert F. Kennedy Jr., has continued promoting that false narrative about that being dangerous. So the Wakefield ideas about autism resulting from the MMR vaccine has now grown and morphed into you know, all these different variations of ways that vaccines can cause harm, that they don't actually cause harm. So it's, you know, he's really taken it and run with it. And it's very frustrating because we're now seeing the hesitancy about the COVID vaccine. Mm-hmm. And I believe that grew directly out of the anti-vaccine movement for kids vaccines and the organization that they developed over the years. So,
yeah. And, you know, let me ask you this. I'm thinking about Wakefield because, yeah, I remember just watching something, some Vice thing, like just in the last couple of years. I think it might have been right before COVID hit. But yeah, there's like, you know, these huge like groups, like Facebook groups of like parents who are still anti-vax and, you know, all that. And they show how like Wakefield is still heavily involved in it. So let me ask you this. And of course, you can never jump into someone's mind, but Do you think that he truly believes this and is worried that children are getting autism from these vaccines or any vaccines are doing harm? Or do you think it's a little bit, you know, like driven by, you know, profit, fame, you know, whatever it is within, you know, these communities?
It's funny you ask that because I do talk about the difference between the grifters and the grifters who are true believers. Because, you know, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., for example, is a grifter, but I think he is a true believer. I think he really, truly believes that kids are being harmed by these vaccines.
Mm.
With Wakefield, I don't know. I mean, keep in mind that his study was fraudulent. Like, he changed the numbers. He violated ethics. It wasn't just a matter of, you know, finding these supposed correlations that didn't exist. He made up correlations that didn't exist. And he also had, this money waiting in the wings for a single measles vaccine that was not was not combined with two other vaccines like the MMR is. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he had a financial incentive. I can't say at this point what he does and doesn't believe in that regard, but I do believe he has a martyr complex. I think the man perceives himself as this persecuted Jesus-like figure who is the savior for all of these parents, and they all look to him. And I don't even know if it matters anymore.
Yeah.
What he believes. I mean, maybe he believed it now and he didn't in the beginning. I really don't know, but I definitely think he has this savior martyr complex, and it's pretty disgusting in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting. I ask myself this a lot because, you know, I'm more of a psychology nerd, and like, you know, I like to read books about biology and stuff like this because it's so important. But, you know, we can lie to ourselves so much. Like, do we eventually believe it? That's why I like to ask people, like, do you think, you know? But I like how you have those two categories of,
I can say confidently that RFK Jr. does believe in the harm. I think Sherry Tenpenny is a sort of an old school, well-known anti-vaccine, I hate saying doctor, but she does have a medical degree, surprisingly, although I don't know when she last actually practiced. And I think she's a true believer. I think she's also a heavy grifter. But unlike Andrew Wakefield is in this weird middle ground. I just don't know.
Yeah. And that, you know, that brings up another question, because part of this conversation, I want, you know, I want people to like kind of have some tips and tools on how to make these decisions, because aside from like vaccines, there's medical decisions that we make on a daily basis. Right. And, you know, I read a ton and I try to like learn about this stuff, but even for me, it gets complicated, you know? So,
yeah, no, it is. It's not simple stuff.
Yeah. And, you know, we turn to the experts, and like you just mentioned, Tenpenny, she has a doctorate, and like Andrew Wakefield, he's a very educated person. Like, he's not just some guy who's in his garage running research.
And he was actually a well-established gastroenterologist until he was struck from the register, which is the equivalent of being disbarred as a doctor in the United Kingdom. So, you know, what you have to do is you can find a crank in every industry, no matter what. Like, you can find structural engineers who believe that 9/11 was an inside job, right? So what you have to do is you have to look at the consensus. And when you look at the consensus of physicians, it, you know, like 99.9999% of doctors are going to tell you that these vaccines have, you know, greater benefits than they have risks. You know, they're as safe as we can make them right now. And you can choose to believe that 99.9999% of doctors are in cahoots together, but that's that's one heck of a conspiracy, you know? Like, it kind of violates the possibility of being able to hide all that information. And, you know, when you have this 0.00001% of doctors who are claiming otherwise, you have to really question their intelligence, but you know, their motives. And, you know, there's a famous joke, like, what do you call the guy who graduates last from medical school? You call him doctor. You know, he still graduated last.
And you know, it's funny too, because completely just unrelated, right before we hopped on to record this, I was talking with somebody about a totally different thing. And, you know, especially right now with COVID, you know, people are like, oh, well, this study and da 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 da, right? And this was actually related to like psychological research. But anyways, they sent me a study, and, you know, I have access, like a lot of people don't have access to the studies, because, and that's a whole thing I could rant about, how, you know, even publicly funded studies are behind these paywalls. That is insane. But anyways. That's something I've learned, right? Like, where's the consensus? What is the majority of the community say? Because that's part of science, right? It's not just one person. There's a process of peer review and da-da-da-da-da, right? But I was just doing this research. And like I said, like, I have access to this stuff. How do we find that consensus? Like, it seems like with bigger issues like climate change, or even like, you know, the COVID vaccine or the MMR vaccine or whatever, like, I could do a quick Google search and like New York Times or someone like yourself has written something on that. But if it was something else that I wanted to find consensus on, like, is there a quick and easy way to find, like, you know, 80% agree with this and 20% don't? Or like, I don't know, like, give me some advice here.
Yeah, well, it depends on what the issue is. If it's talking about a medical issue, go to the professional organization that is associated with that professional issue. Or that medical issue. So, you know, if you're wanting to know a heart related question, you know, you go to the American College of Cardiology. And, you know, the CDC is going to be one source that is, you know, often reliable. I hesitate to tell people to rely on a single source. I'm not going to say, hey, go to the CDC and see what they say and end of story, because, frankly, I think the CDC has taken a hit recently in terms of their credibility. I've had some concerns and issues with them. But what you can do is you can look at what different places say. You can look at, you know, what does the CDC say? What does the National Health Service over in England say, the United Kingdom? What does the Australian Health Service say? What does the European Medicines Agency say? So look at those, and then look at, you know, what does the American Academy of Pediatricians say? You know, so you look at the different sources that are reliable and are made up of individuals who are, you know, following the science on a regular basis, and you compare those, and you're going to see patterns emerge. And the only real opposition that you can raise in response to that is the whole conspiracy thing. Oh, well, it's a conspiracy. They're all in it together, or you know, the wool's being pulled over their eyes. And in the case of something like vaccines, that's a hell of a conspiracy.
Yeah.
Like, it defies mathematical possibility. There's a certain threshold past which, you know, if X number of people are in on it together, they can't hide the secret. So it's just not, you know, it doesn't make sense. And what you'll find also is when you go to those sources, that those resources should also list the sources themselves. Mm-hmm. So you go to the CDC or you go to the American Academy of Pediatrics, and you see the list of studies that they provide. Like, the American Academy of Pediatrics, for example, has a list that you can download from their website that has, it's like, 25 or 30 studies looking at autism and vaccines. And it's nicely organized in this chart format where you can see, you know, what each result was, what each study found. So you want to look for the different groups that are experts in this area. and see how they all match up, basically.
Yeah. That's what I really try to do that. Like, for example, just like with anything, like you said, like I'm in that realm of I try to be as rational as possible. Like the way I think about it when it comes to conspiracies, it's like, have you ever tried to keep a secret with like two or three friends? Like, there is a low chance that one of, like,
exactly,
all three of them, you know,
yeah.
And then they're talking about these massive ones with thousands of, like, not one person, or, you know, they talk about that
exactly.
A lot with the government. Like think about, like, just look at Trump's presidency. Every single person he fired or kicked out had a book deal within, like, a week. You know?
Absolutely, yeah.
So we also, not only do we have to assume that they can't keep a secret, but none of them are driven by profit motives to just write this thing or do some tell-all. So I try to think like that.
Yep.
But one of the biggest challenges, and I'm sure you've noticed this with, you know, talking with so many parents, is how strong confirmation bias is, right? So
yes.
What's a good rule of thumb for how many sources we should check? Because, for example, if I wanted to quote unquote prove that vaccines cause autism, or, you know, COVID vaccines are dangerous, I could quickly find one source and be like, oh, see, it says what I want. You know what I mean? And then just stop. Like, do you have like, a base amount, like when you're doing your own research for different things that you're writing? Do you like look at three? Do you look at 10? Like, how many?
Well, I mean, you have to consider the fact that I had a question about vaccines for my son, and 11 years later, I'm still writing about them. So I might not be the best resource for that.
Yeah.
I will tell you that what I do when I was writing The Informed Parent, there was actually two issues in the book that I had my own confirmation bias about. Like, I knew that I had a pre-existing concern or belief, rather. And I wanted to make sure I wasn't only looking for stuff that confirmed it. So I had to explicitly, purposefully try to persuade myself of the opposite argument. In other words, I explicitly sought out articles that proved the opposite, not proved the opposite, but, you know, that provided scientific support that went against what I believed, while also pulling up the ones that, you know, may have fit better, I guess, what my beliefs were, you know, preconceived beliefs were, so that I knew that I was trying to do what I could to offset the influence of confirmation bias. In the case of those, I was really going in depth. I probably ended up looking at about 25, 30 studies or so, which is a lot more than I would suspect the ordinary person would be able to, well, they wouldn't even be able to get access to most of those studies, to be honest, like you said, the whole issue of paywalls. But in the case of trying to, you know, to make sense of how many different sources to go to, it's really hard because it depends on the issue. I'd say, when I'm trying to check something that pops up on social media, right, where I see something come up and I'm like, wait, what? And I want to do a quick confirmation, I probably look at about five sources. Like, during Trump years, especially, there were so many things that would come out that I was like, wait, is that real? Is that true? Like, what's going on here? And I would do a search and I would look at what, if the quality of the sources matters as well. I would actually intentionally look at sources across a wider range of ideologies. Like, I would purposely look at, you know, what's a more conservative leaning but still reliable source. Like, the Wall Street Journal, for example, is conservative leaning but a reliable source. It wasn't like I was going to Breitbart or whatever. And so I try and get like a variety, but I think, you know, five in that kind of situation is good. For something like vaccines or climate change, that's a lot more complex. And I would, in that case, I would say, you know, look at the expert groups across the world. And you know, once you've gotten to three to five of those expert groups, that would, I think, be sufficient. If you find an expert group that argues the opposite, look at their motives. What are they, what's their goal? What are their underlying motives? Do they have financial motives? Do they have ideological motives? You know, and talk to people that you trust that are in that area, right? I mean, your doctor is on your side. Presumably you chose your kid's pediatrician based on how much you trust the fact that they're a good pediatrician for your kid. If you don't trust your doctor to be able to talk to them about something like vaccines, then, you know, that's concerning on its own.
Yeah, absolutely. And let me tell you, You are one of my new favorite people. And I hope everybody listening rewinds what you just said. All of that was just pure gold. It's so rare that I find people who are like, I try to find the exact opposite opinion and look at it and try to, you know, convince myself otherwise. It's something like, for example, reading an entire book, that takes a long time. It's hours, right? I listen to books at 2x speed. So I do it in half the time of an audio version. But anyways, like, here's a great example. There's a guy who is against climate change. He has a book called The Moral Argument Against Climate Change. Have you heard about that?
No, that sounds concerning though.
It definitely is. But I'm like, okay. Let me see what this guy says. I think his name's Alex something. I can't find it right now. But anyways, I was like, I'm going to sit down and read this guy's book because maybe there's something I'm missing. Maybe a bunch of my fellow left-leaning people are blowing this thing out of proportion. I read that guy's book and I was like, these are the silliest arguments I've ever heard in my life, right? And I don't even have to be a scientist. A lot of people with these weird moral arguments like, basically like, hey, we're the most important people alive and don't care about future generations. And I'm just like, okay, well, just morally, I disagree with you.
Wow, that's not much of an argument.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I hopefully you can give some tips because I'm always thinking, trying to figure out how to explain this to people because, you know, as I'm reading stuff that disagrees with me, right? There's that dissonance that we have to fight, right? Like we want to argue with it. We want to figure out what it takes to disprove what we're reading. And I'm sure as you were trying to figure this out and like do your own research and stuff, that popped up. How did you counterbalance that need to be like, oh, well, this guy's probably just crazy or this research is probably bad and all that?
Well, in my case, I have a little bit of I have the experience of having evaluated that kind of stuff before. So it made it a lot easier to know what to look for because I was reading about scientific information in the science studies that I knew how to read. If I was encountering something brand new that I knew nothing about, then what I do is and this is my job as a journalist, I seek out experts in that area and talk to different people. And I purposely look for a variety of experts to talk to. So a good example is that I'm working on a story right now related to air filters and what's an effective air filter for filtering out SARS-CoV-2 virus in the room. And so I looked for different aerosol scientists to talk to and looked at what they each had to say. And I purposely, you know, would ask, like, is there anyone who's kind of on, you know, what do these different people study and what do they look for when they're publishing things? Because within the scientific community, there's going to be disagreement over things. And the trick is figuring out what are the big disagreements, what are the minor disagreements, and what are the areas where there really isn't actually disagreement, but, you know, even though you think there is. And that's not to say that there's not times when, you know, you'll hear people say things like, quote unquote, science was wrong. And then, it's not that science is right or science is wrong. Science is a process, where you're sort of stumbling toward the truth. And, you know, we're going to learn more things as we go on, but some things have been studied a lot better than others. Yeah. And, you know, vaccines is an example of something it's just been studied so incredibly well that you would have to go out of your way to find studies that contradict what the consensus is. But, you know, the whole field is, it's epistemology. That's the actual field of how do you know what you know? And I think I made a joke about this. Well, I don't even know if it was a joke, to be honest. A couple of months ago, I said probably on Facebook or something or Twitter, I don't remember now, but I'm starting to think that epistemology should be a required course in high school.
I love it. I love it so much. Go ahead.
I mean, we just, you know, we're in a world where it's hard to know things now. And there's such a glut of information. How do you sift through all that? There's not easy answers to that. There's literally a whole department of philosophy devoted to studying that, a whole school of thought devoted to studying that. And it depends on what the stakes are as well. Like if I see this crazy idea come across my screen, how much will that crazy idea necessarily affect my life and my choices, right? Just is it crazy on its own sake? And I want to know if it's true. Or mm-hmm. is it actually going to change substantially how I behave and what I do? When the stakes are higher, I invest more time. When the stakes are lower, you know, mm-hmm. three quick sources aren't that big of a deal.
Yeah, absolutely. How have we not just been best friends forever? This is what I think about all the time. Like when I really got into like books and reading, I wanted to just understand human irrationality and all that. And, you know, I got into like Daniel Kahneman's work and stuff, but then I had stumbled across philosophy and epistemology and like Socratic questioning and just how do we know this, right? How do I know this?
Right.
And there's this weird balance because you don't want to be this like contrarian jerk, right? Where you're just like, well, how do you know what I mean?
I see a lot of people fall into that where they look for the contrary idea because it's contrary, right?
Yeah.
And they're explicitly looking for that. And you have to be careful not to do that. It's easy to fall into that, especially if there's certain personality types that are more likely to fall mm-hmm. into that trap. And you have to be self-aware enough to recognize yourself as one of those personality types to try and guard against that.
Yeah, absolutely. But like you said, I love how you put that too, like high stakes and low stakes. Like there's a great book. I had the author on a couple months ago, Andy Norman. He has a book called Mental Immunity, right? And it's about like, you know, he does this like analogy of like inoculating your brain against like bad ideas and stuff like that. But I was asking him, I'm like, you know, I don't want to question everything, you know, like I don't want to be sitting here like, is her name really Tara? You know what I mean? But for like sticking a needle in my kid, like getting my kid vaccinated and possible health things, like that's high stakes, so I'll spend some more time on it. But
yeah,
here's something I'm regularly wondering about, and you are just the perfect person to ask. So I'm a parent of a 12-year-old boy. And like you were saying, like, I wish we taught epistemology in schools, right? So as a parent, what do you do or what are you planning on doing with your kid about teaching them how to do this and how to look at the world skeptically, but also trusting experts and finding that balance? What are your methods or thoughts behind that?
Well, a quick little side note. When I was a kid, when I was in like second grade, I remember I had some neighbors who I went to their house to hang out with them. And their mom said they couldn't do something. And I said to them, why? And they said, don't say that. And I was like, what? And they said, we're not allowed to ask why. I was like, what? You're not allowed to ask why? Like, that's crazy. And that kind of stuck in my head because I want my kids asking why. In fact, there was even sort of a tension at one point between my mother-in-law and I, which I adore my mother-in-law. She's great. There's not like a bad relationship there or anything, but we were traveling together once and we told our kids to do something. And one of them was like, why? And she was like, do what you're told. I'm like, no, I want him to ask why. I was like, is it a pain in the ass? Yeah, it's a pain in the ass. Does it take extra time? Yeah, but I want my kids to question things. So encouraging them to ask questions and then seeing where they go. You know, I don't always immediately answer their question. Oh, so it depends, you know, it depends on age appropriateness, right? But, you know, if they ask why, I'll say, well, why do you think? And how can we find the answer to that? And you sort of model those sorts of information gathering processes yourself. You know, my kids watch YouTube way too much. And they'll come to me, the younger one is seven, you know, and my seven-year-old come to me and say, mom, did you know, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, really? Where'd you hear that? Well, it was in a YouTube video. I said, well, do you think the YouTube video was true? Or he's like, oh yeah, it's true. And I'm like, well, who made the video? You know? And so you start, you ask the questions that, you know, you would need to ask yourself and you model for them how you investigate that. And I've had him come back and say, oh, well, you know, maybe that one wasn't true. I have to go and check, you know, I mean, they start to pick up on it. So it's simply, in a way, you're modeling the scientific method, right? How do we know what we know? Well, let's ask some questions. You encourage them to be curious. You encourage them to be skeptical, not so skeptical they're questioning the nature of their reality.
Yeah.
I mean, I admit my kids watched The Matrix the other day and it may have been a little bit early for them. It kind of blew their mind.
Tara, what is happening? You're like spying on me. I just introduced my son to The Matrix.
Oh, did you? Yeah. Well, it was actually really funny because my 11-year-old was like, mom, I said The Matrix isn't real. And he's like, mom, I know you said The Matrix wasn't real, but if it was real, we wouldn't know it, would we? And I was like, nope.
I love it. That's so great.
So, So, I mean, you know, and you also have to recognize that, you know, kids need a certain level of security. So you, you don't want to freak them out and make them feel like nothing is knowable, right?
Yeah.
They need to have some sense that their reality is anchored well in reality. So, you know, but I think modeling inquiry, modeling, you know, asking questions, identifying who is an authority and who is, in journalism, we talk about two different types of sources. There's the authoritative sources and there's the accurate sources. And that in ideally, you've got both in one. Like a scientist ideally will be authoritative and accurate. But there are situations where someone's authoritative, such as a politician, that doesn't mean they're accurate. Or maybe they're a grad student that's studying this and they may not have that authoritativeness, but they do have that accuracy, right? So, you know, think about different types of sources that are out there and start weighing the evidence. And a lot of that just, it comes down to practice. And if you don't know how to do it, there's, you know, there's books you can read to you know, read about the scientific process. You know, and honestly, there's even TV shows that, that model this really well. If your kids are really young, I recommend PBS Kids. They have some great TV shows like Dinosaur Train and Molly of Denali. And, you know, these are TV shows that, that do a great job of modeling these kinds of, you know, examples of early scientific inquiry.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember being a kid. I was probably like your friends. Like, I remember asking my parents questions, and like something that just drove me nuts as a kid was because I said so, or, you know, whatever. And I'm like, well, that's not a great answer. You know what I mean? So when, like you said, I do that with my son, I try to model that and ask him questions. And sometimes he gets frustrated. I'm like, oh, well, what do you think? Or how would you find that out? And he's just like, oh, just give me the answer. But it actually started with YouTube as well, because he's, you know, he's a little gamer like myself, and he would play Fortnite and stuff.
Same with my kids.
Yeah, and they come across these videos where it's like, oh, click this link and get a million V-Bucks and all this other stuff. And one rule of thumb I taught my son was, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is, right?
Yeah.
So I've taught him things like, why don't you check the comment section, see if people say it's working, and, you know, almost like checking multiple sources and things like that. And, you know, I try to do that with him. And, you know, he's 12. He's been pretty good about it. But like you said, there's that fine line. Like, sometimes I worry, like, you know, am I taking away some of his imagination or childhood by having him think too deeply about these stuff? So I try to balance it a little bit.
No,
but
I don't think you are. I mean, keep in mind, the greatest like science fiction authors, this is how they approach things, right? So it just meant, you know, depends on the kind of imagination that you're looking for. And I will admit, I mean, I can't say that I'm a parent who's never said I told you so, or who's never said because I said so.
I'm
mixing up my aphorisms. I have definitely been the parent who says, because I said so, but it's usually something like, you know, it's time for bed. Why? Because I said so, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
But one thing I will do, there's two things I do sometimes. One is, depending on what the question is, sometimes the question just demands an answer. They ask if something works and I tell them how it works. So it's not like I tell them to run off and do every single thing on, you know, do a web search on it. Another thing is that, you know, sometimes there's not the time or it's not the right opportunity to explain something, but I also want them to know that it is worth looking up. So sometimes I'll say, okay, I know that's, I'll say, you know, mom, why blah, blah, blah. That's a good question. I can explain that to you, but we don't have time to discuss that right now. So it's something we can talk about tomorrow. So I'll, you know, I'll encourage them to recognize, that's a good thing to explore, but that's just not something we have the time, or this isn't the right opportunity, or, you know, this isn't the time and place to go into that. But yes, you're right to ask that question, and we can revisit this. So that's an alternative to because I said so.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you're ready to write your next book, I think that would be a great topic, because I think about that a lot. Like, how do we teach kids how to think? Because especially with, you know, just how technology is advanced and, you know, looking things up on the internet. Like, my son's getting to a point where, you know, he's doing like research. He just started middle school. Well, back at school because of, you know, COVID lifting a little. But yeah, he's had to look things up, and it's like, okay, well, I want to make sure he's looking up good sources and not falling into rabbit holes of misinformation and all of that. And here's something else I'm curious your thoughts about. And this is for adults as well. Right. So we're talking about like those authoritative sources. And when do you think it's, we should question authority, because for kids, it's much different, right? Like, I've had to have conversations with my son about questioning things, but if your teacher says something strange in class, don't just like call him out in front of everybody, because that could be considered disrespectful. But if something sounds a little off, just know you could talk to me or your mom or whoever and run it by us, and we can do some research. You know what I mean? So how do you balance like questioning authority without turning into a conspiracy theorist, I guess?
Well, it's funny, because in a way, I'm probably the wrong person to ask that to, because I was the one who corrected my teachers. And my job literally as a journalist is to interview people who are in positions of authority and challenge whether or not what they're saying is accurate. So I'm not sure if I'm the best person to answer that question, but I would say, first of all, when you're questioning authority, you should do it respectfully, right? You should do it, you know, it's not, well, that's bullshit, right?
Yeah.
You should say, instead, you want to say something like, well, how do you have, what kind of information do you have that shows that's true, right? So you ask them for their sources, and you can do that in a respectful way that says, you know, I'm listening to you as a position of authority, but I need a little bit more information than just your word here. And so you teach them different ways to approach, you know, I'd like to learn more about that. Can you show me some sources that can help me read more on that? There's a good way to ask, right? And you're not saying, I think you're wrong, or I have reason to doubt you, but you are saying, I am not going to just take your word for this. I want to read more about this myself. So, you know, and then you see what their sources take you to. And then, you know, you look at their sources. Where are their sources? A good example of that right now, you know, Rick DeSantis, the government, or not Rick, it's, gosh, what's his name? Governor DeSantis.
Florida guy.
Yeah, Florida guy. You know, he is claiming that masks are not very effective at preventing the spread of COVID. And so, you know, and he's citing these scientific studies that claim that. Well, okay, there's, you know, this one or two studies that actually have quite a few flaws in them. And then we've got literally over 200 studies over here that show how masks do reduce it. So they do reduce the risk. And so you would say he's an authoritative figure because he's the governor and he's, you know, laying down this policy for his state. But, you know, you look at his sources, and when his sources represent a minority within the scientific community and are not, you know, they don't fit what everybody else in the community is saying, then you have reason to be doubtful of that and want to explore more and learn a bit more and say, well, should I believe the two or three scientists who are claiming this, or should I believe the hundreds of scientists who are saying that over there? Yeah. So I think, you know, you can question authority without being rude or without saying, well, actually, that's wrong. You know, being a little mansplainer or whatever.
Yeah. The well, actually.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, that or little boss lady or whatever you want to call it, right? The little Miss Know-It-All mansplainer, whatever. There's ways to question authority without necessarily, like, you know, trying to intentionally cause friction. And there's times when questioning authority legitimately, like truly saying, okay, now I think you're wrong. There are times when that comes up. I will say that if you're doing it with an audience, the person's going to get defensive a lot faster. So is your goal to draw attention to yourself, or is your goal to get at the truth? Because if your goal is to get at the truth, you'd be better off making an appointment to talk with that person, you know, later on, one-on-one, where there's not an audience present, if you really want to see where they're coming from and why they believe what they believe.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is something I've really learned that, especially over the last, you know, year or two, you know, in COVID, and there's a bunch of other topics that, you know, whatever, but I look a lot at like group psychology and status and stuff. And sometimes people are just trying to like signal like, oh, I'm part of this tribe. So I'll be like, hey, here's my email address if you want to talk in private or whatever, like if it's a conversation online, because in front of an audience, like people have to save face and all that stuff. And Tara, I wish I can keep you here all day, but let me ask you a couple more questions. And one of them is about kind of like, you know, DeSantis in Florida, but all these other politicians right now. And science has become so politicized, I'm sure people like you are going insane, right? But like, here's a question for you. How, like, sometimes I look at it and I'm like, I don't think politicians should be allowed to talk about science, right? So, like, it's important because there are these figureheads that we vote into office and stuff, but so much science has become so politicized. What do you think some solutions are, right? Because some of them are just completely uneducated, right? Or they have a political agenda. Do you, like, I'm sure this has crossed your mind. How can we resolve this and, you know, have them saying the facts and the evidence that has, you know, some validity behind it?
Geez, if I knew that, I'd probably be a millionaire. I don't know. It's really hard because we're in a really difficult place in terms of the politicization of public health and the politicization of science. And, you know, when you have one political party that is heavily rejecting scientific consensus, I don't know what you do with that. I will say a lot of people think this is a new problem. And they think, you know, well, you know, the idea of like authority figures or politicians rejecting science is a modern problem. And I point to two different examples that would say otherwise. One is the infamous example, right, of Copernicus getting excommunicated from the Catholic Church for believing, you know, for suggesting that the Earth was not the center of the universe and that it was in fact the sun, right? Back then, the political body that had the most control was the Catholic Church, and it was political, right?
I mean, that's,
and that's literally centuries old. And then I'll also point to, this was really funny during the Trump administration. Trump would repeatedly use the phrase enemy of the people to refer to media. And there's something interesting a lot of people don't know. I know this because I was a theater nerd and I studied theater in college. And in fact, took a course that focused on this specific playwright. But there's a famous playwright named Henrik Ibsen. He is a Norwegian playwright. Who lived in the like 1880s to 19 something or other, but he wrote a play called An Enemy of the People. The play that more people might be familiar with. He also wrote a play called The Dollhouse or A Dollhouse, and people may be more familiar with that one. And I can't believe I forget which one what it's called. If it's A Doll's House or A Dollhouse with A Dollhouse. I should know which one of those it is. I know it again.
But, we got Google. We'll find it.
But yeah. But An Enemy of the People is a story. You know, that's a play that he wrote in the 1800s. And it's about a doctor who is, you know, there's a Dr. Stockman and then there's the Mayor Stockman and they're brothers. And the mayor is trying to promote these bats in their town as being a source of a health tonic. You know, he's trying to promote the town as this place to go to improve your health and go to these bats. And Dr. Stockman is trying to promote, you know, trying to convey that these bats are actually, you know, these natural springs or whatever actually have sickness in them. And what I find most interesting about this play is that it was written before we understood germ theory. We didn't know what bacteria was when this play was written. And yet that's essentially like Dr. Stockman talks about these microorganisms. That's not the term he uses because that term didn't exist, but that's essentially what it's about. And it's really fascinating because it's the Dr. Stockman versus his brother, Mayor Stockman. And then there's a newspaper in town and the newspaper takes the line of the mayor and, you know, that's where their vested interests lay. And it's this whole play that if you were to read it or if you were to watch it being put on stage today, it's just as relevant as ever. Like it feels like it was written for this moment and it's called An Enemy of the People. And so this is not a new problem. My point here is, you know, this goes back. I mean, if you want to get all philosophical on this, you could say that, you know, for people who are Christian, I mean, Jesus was persecuted by the Romans, right?
He
was
crucified.
So the tension between truth and reality and, you know, science. I'm not going to say that Jesus' message was scientific. I'm not suggesting that's like, quote unquote, truth with a capital T. That's I say that only for those who are you know, Christians who believe that. But the point is that there has always been a tension between your authority figures and their vested interests and the scientific establishment, or, you know, this search or quest for truth. And that's not to be discouraging. It's just to say that we've been at this a long time and we're going to be at it forever. I think there's something fundamentally human about all of this. So we just have to do the best that we can with the resources that we have and try to be, you know, try to make a good faith effort to understand the world and recognize that we have our own sort of cognitive biases that we may or may not be fully aware of that are going to play a role in that. And we just have to do the best we can. The more sources that you seek out and the greater diversity of sources that you seek out, you know, and when I say diversity of sources, I don't mean, you know, that when you're studying the Holocaust, explicitly look for the person who says the Holocaust didn't exist, right?
Yeah.
I'm not saying to purposely follow, you know, jump down the rabbit holes that, you know, are a little bit crazy.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is this is not a new problem. And if the 500, 600, 1,000 years of really, really smart people, much smarter than me, didn't figure this out, I'm not going to be able to give you a satisfying answer.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it too. And I think that's one of the reasons I'm so fascinated by human behavior and our rationality, because, you know, at a certain point we're like designed this way and I'm like, wait, why and stuff. And, you know, I guess my last question for you, since you've been doing this for a while, you know, this is what you do. You communicate science and all that. And, you know, although I think it's impossible for anybody to have 100% success rate communicating science to people and convincing them to, you know, how much truth matters and all that, I'm wondering if you can give someone like me some tips, or anybody listening, like, what are some successful methods to, I don't know, talk with each other? Because I think it starts with us, right? Like, we're not going to change the politicians or even just big corporations who have these vested interests and all that, but we need to talk to each other. And just a quick example, right before we hopped on, I was talking with somebody and I can't explain to them, like, hey, well, this scientific study is bad because of this or invalid or whatever. Like, are there some decent methods for having these conversations that you've seen some success with, even if it's talking with parents about vaccines or anything like that?
Well, it depends on what your goal is. If your goal is to help someone understand that a vaccine actually has greater benefits than risks and is, you know, safe and effective for your child's take, that I have a different approach for that than I would, for example, for something where, you know, there's a genuine greater question at work of what's going on there. The biggest thing is investigating your sources. You know, who else trusts these sources, and why do other people trust those sources, and what do those sources have to say? So, you know, looking at where you're getting your information from is a huge part of that. You also want to listen to what the other person has to say. A lot of people presume that when they're having a scientific discussion, or when they're having a discussion about which quote unquote facts are true, that you simply throw facts at the other person and that's going to make them believe you. And that's not how. When I'm explaining science, I use metaphors, I use similes, I use analogies. I also tell stories. You know, a lot of times a story, you have to keep in mind that every major religion, every faith in our entire world is communicated through story. Right? That story, you know, narrative is the original teaching method. Aesop's fables and, you know, like, that is how we learn, is through stories. And so if your goal is persuasion and to help them understand, you know, why something is true, you need to weave together story and fact. And I'm not saying that to be manipulative. I'm saying that because we don't make decisions based wholly on our rational brain. We make decisions based on a lot of different factors that employ emotion and cognitive biases that we're not fully aware of and all these other things. So, you know, you want to find stories to illustrate the science that you're explaining when you're going through that.
Absolutely. Like, the power of story is big. And like you said, with analogies and stuff like that, like, sometimes we need to find something that people can relate it to and all that. So that's awesome. And Tara, I appreciate you so much. I know you are a super busy woman. So for everybody who just fell in love with you and the work that you're doing and all of that, I'm going to link your books down below, but you write a ton. And like you said, you're working on, you know, a new story. Where is the best place for people to find you, keep up to what, you know, with what you're working on and all that good stuff?
I write regularly for Medium, so they can follow me on Medium. And then probably the easiest place that I usually post most of my stuff is on Twitter. My handle is at Tara Haley, which is at TaraHaelle. And then the articles that I write, I usually post every article that I write on my Facebook page, which is, I think it's, if you look for Tara Haley Journalist on Facebook, it'll pop up.
Beautiful. And last quick question, you got any more books in you, or are you taking a break from that and just focusing on,
These separate pieces? I mean, I've written a bunch of children's books about science. And I'm talking to a editor this week, actually, but right now I'm just tired. Books take a lot. I definitely will write another book at some point. There's no question about that, but it's not going to be anytime soon because this pandemic has really taken its toll, and it's really hard to work on something right now. So
yeah, absolutely. Well, we will all be following you on social media to see what you're working on. So again, thank you so much, Tara. And yeah, when that new book is ready years down the line, we'll link up again and do this again.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right, everybody. That was my conversation with Tara. And yeah, that was my first time chatting with her. And she is a very, very knowledgeable woman. And I learned a ton, because I feel, not to brag, but I feel like I go a little bit further than most to fact check and research some things. But, you know, like I was telling her, there's even things that I'm looking into where I'm like, okay, how do I kind of separate these things and know who to trust? So I learned a ton, and I hope you did too. So yeah, make sure that you're following Tara over on Twitter. Check out her books. All that's linked down in the description below. And yeah, make sure you're following me as well over at The Rewired Soul on Instagram and Twitter. I love chatting with all of you guys, but also I have a lot of cool stuff in the works. I'm working on new projects. I have some new books that are released on some platforms, but not on others. So I'm waiting to do a massive announcement. So yeah, if you're following me over on Instagram and Twitter, you won't miss it. So make sure that you are. And a couple of easy ways to help support the podcast is make sure that you're following the podcast. And if you like this episode, this episode with Tara is super important. If you have friends who are parents, or you know people who are vaccine hesitant, or people who fall for misinformation, or just need to have a better understanding about how to understand the science that's coming our way, share this episode. All right. Share it on your favorite social media platform or any other episode that you enjoy. All right. But yeah, some other ways you can support the channel, check out therewiredsoul.com. I have written some books on mental health and addiction recovery. And there's also an affiliate link down below for BetterHelp online therapy. Mental health is a huge part of my life. I've used BetterHelp. So if this is something that you're interested in, check out that affiliate link down below. All right. So another huge, huge thanks to Tara for taking the time to come on, and make sure you are following her and check out her books. All right. But anyways, that's all we got for this episode. I have one more episode for you coming up tomorrow. So stay tuned. Have an amazing rest of your day, and I'll see you next time.